Shalom. Thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery through the book of Deuteronomy.
Shalom and welcome back to our series on Deuteronomy. We are at the penultimate or almost penultimate episode now. They were coming right to the very end. And today we are looking at chapter 32. And chapter 32 is sometimes called the Ha'azinu, which really comes from the first word of this passage that's otherwise known as the Song of Moses. And it is very interesting as we go through. So we're going to just jump right into it because, you know, I think the interesting parts will come. Let's start by looking at verses 1 and 2. Give ear, O heavens. Again, by the way, remembering this is happening at the time when Moses was about to enter, about to die, and the children of Israel were about to enter in the promised land. So he was addressing this, I guess you could say, the second generation, right? The second generation that has traveled from those that actually came out from Egypt. So Moses now is actually addressing them with these final words, and he has this song. He writes this song on the spot. Now, whether or not it is Moses who wrote the song, I guess we'll see as we go along. It says, "Give ear, O heavens, and I," meaning Moses, "will speak. O hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let me teach. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb, and as showers on the grass." Oh, that's a pretty nice introduction. Imagine I started my sermon like this, right? Yeah. "Let my words fall on you like, you know, raindrops," and okay. But it's a song, right? And he says, "For I proclaim the name of Jehovah." Okay, that's really interesting. By the way, I should probably take a second to say this. Your Bible, whenever you get this capital L-O-R-D, right? It's actually Jehovah, or, you know, some people call it Yahweh. Scholars kind of a little bit divided. I tend to lean towards Jehovah. But the name of Jehovah, so that is important. But, you know, in all our Bibles, we never mention the name, right? Instead of proclaiming the name of Jehovah, we're proclaiming the sort of like some other word, right? So, and in the Hebrew manuscript, it has Jehovah, but the later manuscripts has often a dot above the word Jehovah in what is called the fricative, right? So that's saying that it is written this way, but you shall read it as Adonai or something else. Okay, anyway, it is a good name, the name of Jehovah. "Ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect." You know this song, right? This is a song we sing all the time. It's actually the words from the Song of Moses. "For all his ways are just this." Well, I guess all his ways are just. "And a God of truth, without injustice, righteous and upright is he." This is a very familiar verse because we've been singing this quite a lot. You know, the LXX, which is the Septuagint, says, "God, true are God's works." Right? So when you say his works are justice, what you mean is that his works are true, or his ways are true, if you like. His ways are true. He's a truthful God. And all his ways are judgment. That's the literal translation from the Greek, right? "God is faithful and he's not unrighteous." The Dead Sea Scrolls is missing this entire verse, right? So you might not have that in your song if you simply use the Dead Sea Scrolls. Verse 5 and 6, you know, Moses, again, he's writing about Israel, right? He's saying, "They have corrupted themselves." Who is they? Probably the first generation, right? Again, this is the second generation. He's talking about they, not you. You being the generation he's addressing. So that first generation, they have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish. A perverse and crooked generation. See what I mean? Moses is angry. He's one angry guy. And he's very unhappy with that whole lot. Maybe because he feels that they caused him to not be able to enter the promised land, right? So I think when he says they are not his children, are they or are they not his children? I guess this is something that you can see as a bit of an emotional statement, right? A poetic hyperbole in a song. And verse 7, "Remember the old days, consider the many generations." This is remembering the salvific works of God, right? And then he says this, "Ask your fathers and he will show you." Okay, this one we can understand, right? Because this is the second generation. "Ask your fathers," which is the first generation. You can ask your elders, they will tell you. This one we can understand. "When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, he separated the sons of Adam." He set boundaries. What on earth is going on? The sons of Adam, he set boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. See, this thing has not happened yet. You understand what I'm saying? This has not happened yet. They have not actually entered into the promised land. They have not set up boundaries. So some people are looking at this. Hey, this one is a bit out of place. I mean, historically, this should come at a much later date. And then verse 8. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam. Okay, let's just take a couple of seconds here. Slight discussion, all right? Who is the Most High? This Most High comes from the Hebrew word El Elyon. Okay, so El usually means God, right? El Shaddai, and is that God? Elyon or Alyon means, you know, high or the highest, right? So El Elyon is actually a name that's sometimes used to refer to God. But so too, a name like Baal is sometimes used to refer to God. You know, although it is the proper name of a Canaanite god. So where do we get this name El Elyon before? So maybe you can look at Genesis chapter, let's say Genesis chapter 14 verse 18, right? Let's just kind of look at Genesis chapter 14 verse 18. You have this Melchizedek, the king of Salem. Okay, does anyone know what city Salem is? Jerusalem, that's right. I mean, that's the old name of this Jebusite city that later on came to become Jerusalem. So there was the king of this city that was, you know, was Jerusalem. He brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of the God Most High, of El Elyon. So who is El Elyon? Is Melchizedek a priest of Jehovah? That's the question, right? Or is he a priest of El Elyon, one of the Canaanite gods? This is a very interesting, for me anyway, it is a very interesting discussion. He blessed him. Who blessed who? Who blessed who? Verse 19. He blessed him, right? And said, blessed be Abraham, the of God Most High. Okay, so Melchizedek is now, the first he is Melchizedek. The second he is Abraham, right? Or Abraham. And blessed, he calls Abraham, Abraham of God Most High. Actually, Abraham of El Elyon, right? El Elyon. Possessor of heaven and earth, blessed be El Elyon, who has delivered your enemies in your hands. So Melchizedek attributes Abraham's victory to this God called El Elyon. And Abraham then answers, okay? Abraham said, okay, well, let me see. Where does Abraham answer? Where does he answer? Verse 22. Abraham said to the king of Sodom and raised his hand to... Okay, now what does your English version say? To Lord in capitals, right? So, here's what I think is going on, right? Melchizedek is saying, look, Abraham, El Elyon has done this to you. The God Most High has done to you. And Abraham says, I raise my hand to Jehovah, the Most High God. Okay, so I think there might be a little bit of sort of like tension there, whereas Abraham says, well, for me the Most High God is Jehovah. It's kind of corrects Melchizedek. Anyway, that's a lot more interesting discussion, which, you know, we won't get right here. But so now there's this whole attribution to El Elyon, and now back here, and by the way, this is the only instance of the word El Elyon in this law, apart from Genesis, right? In the actual laws, this is the only time when God is called El Elyon. Everywhere else is called Yehovah or something else. Well, okay, I'm going to go on to Bnei Israel, the sons of Israel. And the LXX actually calls this as angels instead of sons of Israel. Now, why? Because in the Old Testament, really in law, sometimes Bnei Elohim, the sons of God, are sometimes translated as angels. So, you know, it is possible that some translators felt that, you know, this must be referring to God. Anyway, in this verse, he says, we are talking at verse 9. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. So Jacob here is just another word for Israel, right? Because Jacob's name was changed to Israel. It's not really referring to Jacob the person, although it might. But I think here it's most likely a way of saying Israel. He found him in a desert land. God found Jacob or Israel in a desert land? and in a wasteland, a howling wilderness, he answered God. Okay, wait, what's going on here? As the eagle stirs up his nest, hovers over its young, spread out its wings, taking out. So God is saying that in this poetic language, I cannot take too literally, poetic language, God is someone who found Israel wandering around in some wasteland, maybe in, I don't know, where did God find Abraham? I guess in Ur, right? Somewhere. But God now picks him up like an eagle, right? Stirs up the nest, taking them up, carrying them on their wings, which is the language that God used to speak of the people coming out from Egypt, right? Eagle taking them out. So the Lord alone led them. There was no foreign God, right? No other God allowed to take any credit for this whole thing. And then verse 13 and 14, what does this refer to? He made him ride in the heights of the earth. So, meaning that God made Jacob or Israel ride in the heights of the earth. Again, you cannot overanalyze songs, you know, because songs are poetic language. I'm not quite sure what it means by ride the heights of the earth. Fly around, I guess, right? That he might eat the produce of the fields. He may draw honey from the rock. We have a song about honey from the rock, isn't it? Right? And oil from the flinty rock. That is to say, out of terrible things, you can get something nice, right? Curds from the cattle. Okay, we're getting a bit complicated here. Milk from the flock, fat of lambs, ram from the breed of Bashan. But Jeshurun grew fat and cake. Okay, bonus question. Who is Jeshurun? Out of the blue, suddenly there's Jeshurun. Who is Jeshurun? That's right. Yisrael is the Hebrew way of saying Israel, right? And Yeshurun, Y-I-S-H-R, is all the same. Just the last two bits are different. And actually here, Jeshurun is just another name, maybe due to some textual corruption at the end there, Israel. But then, you know, this name does appear elsewhere in the next chapter. For example, it talks about Yeshurun. So actually, when it says Yeshurun, when it says Jacob, these are just all different ways of saying Israel. Why? I'm not very sure. Why suddenly they use Yeshurun here? I'm also not very sure. Scholars have many different opinions as to why this. The word Yashar means straight. But then from Moses' point of view, this is as crooked a generation as can be. So it's kind of strange for him to purposely call this a straight nation if his idea is that these are crooked and perverse generation, as he said earlier, right? So this verse, Yeshurun, refers to the people who forgot God, right? Because in verse 15, it says, he grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick. Wow, it actually rhymes in English, right? You kick, you thick, you know? It's like he attack, he protect, you know? So you are obese, well, and he forsook God. So in other words, now, this is not fat shaming or anything like this, right? This is really saying that when he prospered, when he did well. Now, what is wrong with all of this stuff? None of this has happened yet. They are not even in the promised land yet. They have not prospered yet. They were actually just coming out of wilderness. But Moses, maybe he thought, nah, I won't be around to scold you later. So I might as well just scold you right now. Okay, just remember this. I'm scolding you in advance. So a lot of this stuff is what we call anachronistic, in that it seems to be talking about a time that has not happened yet. Right? He's talking about future. He's scolding them for stuff they have not even done yet. He's talking about land that's divided that they have not even possessed. And scornfully esteemed the rock. By the way, the rock is another way of saying God, right? The rock of his salvation, the God of his salvation. They provoke him to jealousy with foreign gods, with abomination. All this stuff have not happened yet. Abominations, they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons. The word demons here, very interesting, shed. Now, in the Old Testament, you don't actually get a lot of actual reference to demons of the kind that you see in the New Testament, right? A lot of these demons are actually just idols. So the shed, in this case, is what you might call a satyr, right? A satyr, which is, you know, the legs of a goat and the body of some other creature, right? So a shed is sometimes seen as one of these gods of the wilderness that they prayed to. And the people were afraid, so they prayed to these gods, these idols. But the word shed is also the word from which you get another word that's adopted into Jewish belief, which is Shaddai. El Shaddai. It's also which, you know, Shaddai, they'll say Almighty, right? When you see the word God Almighty, that's El Shaddai. But actually, it comes from the word. So, something notice here. The words like Baal, words like El Elyon, words like Shed, and many other words, which actually were the language, the religious language of the culture of the day, were eventually adopted. You know, they were actually assimilated, or some people would say syncretized. And they started calling Yehovah by these names. So, you know, there are people who tell you, you know, God has all these names. Listen, God has only one name, right? A lot of these are actually titles that later on were assimilated. But, you know, they became used as part of the liturgy of the people. What does God think about this process, you know? It's interesting because later on you see that God actually refused to use this. Maybe Joseph, I was going to say Titus. Read for us Hosea chapter 2, verse 16 and 17. Remember, the word Baal also means husband. It also means Lord, but, you know, it's master. But it's actually the proper name of one of these gods. Okay, so verse 16 and 17.
Hosea chapter 2, verse 16. And it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that you will call me my husband, and no longer call me my master.
Okay, pause for a second. What is going on here, right? See, normally master and husband, okay, is the word Baal. But over here, the word husband is Ish, which is a different word for husband. So in other words, say, you will call me Ish and you will not call me Baal. You will not use the name Baal. Why? Okay, verse 17.
For I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and they shall be remembered by their name no more.
Okay, so what's going on? So God is saying, look, you guys have taken all these other names. You started calling me, Yehovah, by Baal, by the names of, you know, all these other names, right? On that day, you will stop doing this. You will no longer call me Baal. You no longer call me Shed, I suppose. You no longer call me even El Elyon, perhaps, right? Because these were the names of these other gods. You call me by a more neutral name, Ish, or something like this. So, it's interesting. Why do I keep mentioning the word Yehovah, for example? I'm trying to do this. I'm trying not to use the other names. I'm trying to use the name of God because God wants to be called by his name. They sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals, okay? Now, you got to understand something about the practice. For a lot of the ancient peoples, they had territorial gods. So you enter a particular territory, you automatically pay tribute to the gods. Just like kings, right? If you enter a particular land, you pay tribute to whoever is the tribal chief of that land. They viewed gods a little bit like that, right? Also, they had gods of like thunder, gods of storm and such things like that. And of course, their gods had consorts, they had wives. So they actually have a whole pantheon of all kinds of gods. And God says there are some new gods, new arrivals, meaning that gods that they did not know before because they entered into new lands, right? And it's not as if the gods suddenly arrived from somewhere like, you know, aliens like this, but they enter in a new land, they conquer new lands, but in this new lands, they were introduced to new gods. By the way, since you come here, I let you know we have a kitchen god. You don't pray to kitchen god, your food won't be nice. So, you know, this new gods, God says, no, right? This is something that God is very, very upset about that the people do. But keep in mind, all of this stuff has not happened yet. Right, they are being scolded in advance, so that their fathers did not hear of the rock again, meaning God who begot you. You are unmindful. It means you forgot your own God. You went after all these new gods and whatnot, right? And by the way, did they go after these other gods eventually? Absolutely. David was trying to escape from Saul, right? So he climbs out the window. His wife puts something in his bed. What did he put in his bed? A kitchen idol. Wait a minute. How come you conveniently have one kitchen idol lying around, you know? Obviously, they have these idols even in David's household. That's you think about that, okay? So, you know, I guess they were right to be scolded in advance, lah. Of the rock who begot you, okay, you forgot the God because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters, right? So we are at verse 20 now. Verse 20, God will hide himself from Israel, right? He said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are in other words, God. You know, I'm going to separate myself from you. I'll just look and let you see. You know, Chinese, we like to say something like, okay, I'll see what happened to you. Okay, that's basically God saying that. Okay, right, you want to do, you do. I'll see you. So he folds his hands, and I'm going to see what end you come to, right? So God is getting angry. They provoke me to jealousy by what is not God. They move me to anger by their foolish idols. But I will provoke them to, okay, before the first two verse, first two, the 21a, right, the first half. So, you know, the whole theme of Deuteronomy is God's anger and laws against idolatry. Okay, if nothing else, you understand this is one of the major, major themes. There are a few major themes. This is one of the biggest themes against idolatry. And then the second part, because you have provoked me to jealousy, right? God is going to pay back, right? I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. Okay, let's pause for a second here. I is God, right? Here, I refers to God. God will provoke them. Who? Who will God provoke? Of course, we are Christians, right? You're thinking of Romans, and you're thinking of God using the nations to provoke Israel to jealousy, right? But who will God use to provoke them? According to this, by those who are not a nation. Who on earth is by those who are not a nation? Because you see, you could read this another way around. You could read this as God will provoke the world to jealousy by those who are not a nation, but now he calls them to be a nation. In other words, Israel. God will use Israel to provoke the world to jealousy. But again, you know, that may be possible. Most likely, God is using the nations of the world to provoke Israel to jealousy as a kind of punishment, right? So, I'll show you how it feels like. And I will move that, okay, by the way, remember, this is all poetry, This is all poetry, this is all songs, and songs and poetry are sometimes given to poetic license. Sometimes it will use words that are a little bit extreme. For I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. Again, I have to wonder, if this is a Gentile nation, who is the foolish nation that God will use to provoke the people of Israel into jealousy? Conversely, the foolish nation could be Israel that God is using to get the attention of the rest of the world. You know, however you like to read it. For a fire is kindled in my anger, I will burn, and it shall burn. Okay, great. This is going to have some interesting discussion here. It shall burn to Sheol Taharit, which is the lowest Sheol. What? First of all, Sheol does have how many levels first? There's no levels to Sheol, right? So this is just saying the lowest grave. Now, what is Sheol? How does your Bible translate the word Sheol? The lowest hell. That's so interesting. Now, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there's no concept of hell as we have in the New Testament, right? In the New Testament, you occasionally find the word Gehenna. So what is Gehenna? Gehenna is actually a shortened word from the word Ge ben Hinnom. Okay, Ge is not someone's surname, but it's it's actually valley. The valley, Ben is son, Hinnom. So Ge ben Hinnom is the valley of the sons of Hinnom. Right? It's part of the Kidron Valley. Right, just next to the temple. So when you contract Ge ben Hinnom, you get Gehenna. Why is this so called translated as hell? Because in that valley was where they had the sacrifice to Molech, right? They had this bronze statue, and you can read about this in Jeremiah. They had this bronze statue where they heat it up until it's red hot, and then they'll sacrifice the babies. They put in the hands of this burning bronze statue, and the babies will cry, right? And while they're doing that, you know, they'll beat the drums, you know, the tophet, and so that the parents will not hear the baby crying. That's what they did. And that's a terrible place. There's a burning, the screaming, the flesh. This place was so terrible that they came to, no, this is what, if there's going to be a hell, punishment, this became the picture of what punishment was, right? So that's hell as they saw it. There's no conceptual, not yet anyway, idea that there's some, you know, metaphysical hell, not yet. So here, Sheol is not that. The Jews at this stage believe that when you die, you just die. You just went to somewhere. Sheol is that somewhere. This dark, shadowy place where nothing much happens, you're right? Nothing much happens there. You are just there. And so when they say, I go down to hell, it doesn't mean they go because, you know, I mean, everybody goes to Sheol. It's not like some people don't go to Sheol, right? So it's very interesting when you see how this idea of death, for them, once you're dead, you're dead. There's no idea of resurrection. There's no idea. That, all that came a little bit later. At this stage in the Old Testament, as far as they're concerned, they're dead. They're kind of dead, right? A few cases, you have people who are taken up, like Enoch maybe, or let's say subsequently you have Elijah, for example, right? And a few others, you have one or two people who seem to break the trend. But by and large, the idea that when you're dead, and of course you find that in Psalms, for example, let's try, let's see. Psalm 16 verse 10.
Psalms 16 verse 10. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption.
Right. So leave the soul in Sheol. It's just a storage place, I guess. That's what happens when people die. That's sort of how they explain it. It doesn't mean that they have some theological proof. Someone went there and came back and explained to them. This is just how people understood. Well, whatever happens to you after that, that is the Sheol is the definition, right? So the idea of resurrection really evolved a little bit later, which is why in the New Testament, there was a debate between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, right? And about whether there was or there wasn't a resurrection. So it wasn't as if from day one, they had all these theological ideas. Many of these ideas developed as they went along, okay? And or at least you could say they gained more understanding as they went along. So, very interesting. I don't think I want to go in too much to talk about Sheol because it is very interesting. Because subsequently, you have this idea of redemption from Sheol, right? Yeah, you go there, but maybe that's a way of getting out. Of course, in the cultures outside of it, really surrounding cultures, they had many ideas. The Egyptians had ideas of, you know, what happens when you go down to the dead. They have this boat and all that, right? And the Greeks have other myths about that, how there's a river that goes into hell. A river's name is called Styx, S-T-Y-X. You see some name appear in some music groups and all that. That's actually the name of the river that runs into hell, right? And supposedly there were stories about how people went in to save their loved ones. It came up. Very interesting stuff, okay? So, here really it simply means, it doesn't mean you go to hell and get punished forever. Not that hell. It just means you're going down to Sheol, okay? Verse 26, I will have said, I will dash them to pieces and I will make the memory of them cease from among men, right? In other words, I'll blot out their memory. We've spoken about this earlier on, how this was really, in many cases for Jews, the ultimate punishment, to have no more memory, right? No more descendants. And this was really the fulfillment of the curse of Deuteronomy, the ultimate punishment. I will wipe them out completely. Had I not feared the wrath of the enemy? Okay, so let's pause here for a second, right? So who's talking in verse 26? I will dash them to pieces. Who do you think is talking? God is talking, right? God is saying, I will dash who to pieces? All these disobedient people to pieces, right? So God is saying, I will destroy them. But then in the next verse, he says, had I not feared the wrath of the enemy? Okay, this is going to mess up our mind, right? Wait a minute. Is God saying, I would have destroyed all of them? Had I not feared, God doesn't fear anyone. So how is it that suddenly he says, had I not feared the wrath of the enemy, lest the adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is high, and it is not the Lord who has done, it is not the Lord who has done all this. So it's very confusing. To be honest, I think as you go through this whole song, you find that there's a lot of this sort of confusion, changing of first person to second to third person at inappropriate times, anachronism, things that haven't happened yet, but they're getting scolded for it. You know, it is a very interesting study for those who want to look into the literary structure of it, right? So then also you have in verse 26, right, it says, I would have said, right? Actually, I have said. The Hebrew is just, I have said. I would dash them to pieces. So who is afraid of who? It seems that maybe one possibility is that God didn't want to give the enemy credit, right? If I destroy them, then maybe they'll say, look, this God of theirs, this Yehovah, is powerless. That's why his own people. So they might mistaken that instead of God destroying Israel, they would have thought that they have won over Israel. So this is a three-party fight, right? You have God, you have Israel, and you have the nations. And God is punishing Israel, but God does not want the nations to think that they have won over Israel. Okay? So the story is like this. I can slap my son, but you cannot slap my son. Okay? I slap my son, he cried. I don't want you to think you did it, okay? So maybe I won't slap him, although I'm angry at him because I don't want you to. It's very complicated, okay? Three-way kind of story. So, and verse 31, of course, for their rock is not like our rock. Okay, this we're not talking about rocks here, okay? We're talking about God. So their God is not like our God, even our enemies themselves being judges for them. Okay, a lot of strange language going on. I'm just going to jump through all this. You should read this yourself. It's very interesting. Let's go straight to verse 36. In verse 36, well, verse 35, vengeance is mine and recompense. We quote this a lot. Their foot shall slip in due time, for the day of the calamity is at hand, and the things to come hasten upon them. For the Lord will judge his people and have compassion on his servants. Now, here's a different kind of judging. The word judge here means yadin. It also means consider, right? So God will consider his people and have compassion, right? So I think it makes a lot more sense than say the Lord will judge his people, which seems to be negative, and have compassion, which has positive. Actually, it's really God will consider, Yahweh will consider his own people, and he will have compassion on his servants, right? And he shall see that when their power is gone, so God will have a pity, and when they're so powerless, that there's none remaining born or free. He'll say, where are their gods, right? Since you ran after all these other gods, right? So where are they now? Are they going to help you? Remember, this is the song of Moses. This is a song that Moses is writing. And in the song, Moses is expressing, I think he's projecting his own anger. This is my actual feeling. I think Moses is very angry with people. So when he writes the song, the God of his song is also very angry. This is my hunch, okay? This is my personal opinion, the hunch I get from reading all this, right? So Moses is very upset with these people for some reason. Okay, so I'm going to move on. Verse 39. Now see that I am, even I am he. Okay, this word in Hebrew is ani, ani, hu'ah. Now, you want to learn some Hebrew, right? In Hebrew, he, the word he in Hebrew is she. He is she, right? Who is he? Right? Who? So ani, ani, hu'ah. It's I am he, okay? So who is he? He is she. Okay? It's complicated. Yeah. Okay? So, but here is ani. Ani means me, right? I am he. Ani, ani, hua. Right? So that's why it's the translation a bit clumsy, but I am he. That God alone is he. Who is he? There is no God beside me. Right? I kill, I make alive. I wound, I heal. Nor is there any who can deliver from my hand. Sometime ago, I preached a sermon talking about why there are no this meta divines, you know. In other words, in this early part of Israel, God was the only actor. All the other so-called demons or pagan gods, these are all nothing. They have no power whatsoever. They are not even real beings. There are no spirits. There are no ghosts. There's only God. This is actually what it says. There is only God. And because there's only God, God alone must be responsible for all the good, but also all the bad, right? Which is actually what you find in Isaiah 45. Let's kind of maybe look at Isaiah 45, verse 5 to 7, okay? Isaiah 45, verse 5 to 7, right? You find this again. He kills, he makes alive. Sickness, health is all from God in this early view, right? Isaiah 45, verse 5 to 7.
Isaiah 45, verse 5. I am the Lord, and there is no other. There is no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that it may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Verse 7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. Verse 8, rain down, you heavens from above, and let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the earth open, let them bring forth salvation, and let righteousness spring up together. I, the Lord, have created it.
Okay, so in verse 7, it says, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create calamity. You see that word there, calamity? That's in NKJV. The word calamity here, actually, I don't even know why everywhere else is the word evil, right? But the theologians say, how can God create evil, right? Because many of us, we are in a kind of dualistic world. Who is responsible for evil? Satan. But in this world, there's no Satan. There's only God. Therefore, there's no room for superstition. There's no room for afraid of any other people. All of these are fake. For Isaiah, these idols are just wood only. They have no power whatsoever. They're not even half a spirit or anything in these things. But later on, as you move, when they go into the land, not only did they syncretize with the names of all these other gods, they actually started to buy into that worldview. And basically, you end up with a superstitious worldview where there are demons and all kinds of things, right? So at least here, at least in the very early part of the Bible, actually, it is not a dualistic worldview. It is just God and God alone. And that's sort of the thing. Of course, you know, some of us will start asking, but what about all this later on? Maybe we'll come to that in some other book study. But at least for Deuteronomy, that didn't exist, right?
Of course, but then there's evil and then there's the concept of sin, right?
Sin.
And most people tend to conflate the two. So okay, maybe there can be some.
I think sin is obvious. Disobedience to God is like very obvious what is sin, right? And wickedness is all in relation to God. So who is a wicked person? Someone who disobeys God's rules, God's laws. That's a wicked person, right? So the other kind of wickedness would be seen as idolatry, already running after foolish other gods. So it's this very complicated idea that the world around them is actually rife with paganism. Many gods, attributions to all kinds of things. When something goes on, you can, maybe this god, maybe it's that god, maybe it's all kinds of things. Maybe it's magic, maybe it's curses. In Israel, they are trying to create a religion that rejects all of these things, right? They are rejecting magic. They are rejecting incantations. They are rejecting secret knowledge. They are rejecting all of this. They are trying to create a place where it is pure, where there's only one God. But of course, you must understand there's a flood that's coming in, right? And you're trying to hold out the flood with these very strong words and very strong laws. And I guess in the long run, the flood broke through, right? So that's why the way the belief system evolved was like this. Okay, I'm just going to move on a little bit here. Very interesting stuff. And live forever as a form of oath. And we're almost done here. Verse 40. By the way, there's some pronouncement of judgment against God's enemies as well here, right? Then you end with this last part here, which is verse 43 says, "Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people." Look at that. That's just a funny way of ending this particular song, isn't it? The song has been talking about, you know, God punishing the people, punishing everyone, punishing everything. Finally, okay, now let's rejoice, because the song has come to an end. "Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants." Now, just think about this. Rejoice, the word Gentiles here, right? The word Gentiles that you actually have is the word goy. In other words, the nations, right? So whenever you see the Bible has the word goy or Gentiles, in the Old Testament, it means nations. In the New Testament is a word ethne, right? The nations, okay? So, "Rejoice, nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants." Just think about how messy this statement is, right? Rejoice, everybody, nations, everybody. God is going to punish who? Who? Who is God going to punish? Avenging the blood of his... No, he's going to avenge the blood of his servants. Who are the ones? The nations, okay? Rejoice, everybody. God is going to punish you, right, for hurting my servant Israel. I don't know why you're asking them to rejoice. I'm not quite sure this is a particular joyful event. That's what I mean by this is a very messy song, okay? So, but it is a song, okay? In songs, we all write not so accurately sometimes. "And render vengeance on his adversaries," meaning the enemies of, which are the nations, right? "He will provide atonement for his land and his people." Okay, maybe among the nations, not all are enemies of God's people. There are some worse enemies, okay? So you Assyria, you Babylon, you Egypt, sorry for you guys. You're the adversaries and God's going to punish. Maybe. Maybe only some will get punished. Maybe the rest of them can rejoice, you know, because you stand on the side of God. So that's sort of like the end of the song. song proper. Okay, the couple of verses that go on that sort of like from verse 44 onwards, that you switch out of the song. Moses came to Joshua the son of Nun and spoke all the words of the song. Again, I look at this thing. Moses came with Joshua. This doesn't seem like it's Joshua or Moses writing this anymore, isn't it? This is someone else now describing. You're switching to another person. That is probably not Joshua. Unless Joshua is writing of himself in the third person, which is a little bit strange. So someone else writing, Moses came with Joshua the son of Nun and spoke all these words of song in the hearing of all the people. Maybe he composed it on the spot. What do you think? I don't think so. I think quite... Okay, some people are really good at this. You know, they can just like boom, boom, you know, and then they start saying, you know, we are studying Deuteronomy, you know, we all love history, you know. You just write the stuff up like that, right? I don't think so. I think this must be a later, more complete work, right? But it's attributed like this. Moses finished speaking all the words, meaning the law and everything else, to Israel. He said to them, set your hearts on all the words which I testify among you today, which you shall command your children, and be careful to observe all the words of this law. For it is not a futile thing for you, because it is your life. This law is your life. It's for your life, in other words, right? This law is for your life. It is for your own welfare, if you like. By this word, you shall prolong your days. So when it says this law is your life, it really means, look, this is for your own good. That is what the father is saying to the children. Listen, I have very strict laws, very fierce punishment, but listen, obey it, because it is for your own good. Okay, it is for your own good. You prolong your life, your days in the land in which you cross over the Jordan to possess. Then the Lord spoke to Moses. This is the last part, verse 48, right? God spoke to Moses that very day. You know, it was that day itself when he finished saying all these things. God spoke to him to ascend onto the mountain of Avarim. Okay, you know, it was what they call the beyond. Okay, that's the name of the mountain, Mountain of Avarim. And Mount Nebo, which is, so I guess you have a group of mountains. One of the mountains there is Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, which faces Jericho. Whoever was writing this part was writing from a perspective of having already crossed the Jordan, because he's talking about the other side, right? So, but the translators try to make it a little bit more historically and chronologically correct by the translation translates it as if they are still in Moab. But here, the original text is written from having been into the land. So let's have a look at that. So what happens here? Moses says all these things. God tells Moses, now go up to this mountain, right? Let's have a look at that, right? Verse 48. Go up to this mountain, 49, of Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is on the land across, and view the land of Canaan, which I give the children of Israel as a possession, and then die on the mountain. Okay, so you go up the mountain, have a good look as much as you want, and after that, you are to die on this mountain, and then you'll be gathered with your brother Aaron, right? Who died on Mount Hor. Okay, if you look at Numbers chapter 27, okay, let's look at Numbers chapter 27, verse 12 to 14. Numbers chapter 27, verse 12, right? The Lord said to Moses, go up to this mountain, Abarim, see the land which I have given you, and when you have seen it, you shall also be gathered for the wilderness. Okay, so same account, for the wilderness of Zin. Okay, there's a bracket there. Then Moses said to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go up before them. In other words, God at that point says, let's appoint somebody. Right? Let's appoint somebody. After God told him these things. But actually, in Deuteronomy, Joshua has already been appointed and commissioned. So the chronology there is a little bit different, right? If you look at in Numbers 27, you find that Joshua was commissioned and selected after God told him to go up this mountain, right? The last thing he did was God told Moses, go up to this mountain, and Moses, okay, I'm going up, but Lord, would you commission now someone to take after me? And this man is Joshua. But you look in Deuteronomy, the sequence of events is different. In the last few chapters, Joshua was already commissioned, anointed, already charged with whatever he's supposed to do. And then, so you know, you find that in this recounting, sometimes the order of things are a bit, they're not so tight, okay? So, you know, if you want to study this Old Testament, you cannot be overly OCD. If you want everything to line up properly, sometimes it does get messy, right? So, Moses finally died on the mountain. Chapter 32 and verse 50. Right? He goes up there, he dies. He dies at the age of 120. Right? And the Bible says he dies because, what does it say? Verse 51. Because you trespass against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel. And for that reason, he died before he could go in the promised land. What about Aaron? Why did Aaron die? Numbers chapter 20, verse 24. Let's take a quick look at that. Numbers chapter 20, verse 24. Aaron shall be gathered. Now, when the Bible says gathered, is a nice way of saying he'll die. Okay. So when we are gathered together, some can mean that we die together, right? So Aaron shall be gathered to his people, meaning he dies. He shall not enter the land which I have given to the children of Israel, because you rebelled at my word. Same reason. The reason why Aaron could not enter as well was for the same reason. In other words, although Aaron was the one who made the golden calf, Moses was held accountable as well, right? For the collective disobedience. Although Moses has his own disobedience, Aaron has his own, but actually they all were rejected for the same exact reason. The entire generation suffered for that disobedience. Okay, that brings us to the end of this chapter 32, and we have only one more. I know this has been a long chapter, but because, you know, I didn't want to chop up the song into two pieces. I hope this has been enjoyable and enlightening to you. And if you have questions, feel free to write it down in the comment section below. Otherwise, join us one more time for our final episode, the last two chapters of Deuteronomy. God bless you.
We hope you enjoyed studying the Word of God. Join us again as we continue through the book of Devarim.